The matter of Bank of America versus Thomas Mayor. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Rebecca Shore, SCHORE, Legal Services of New Jersey, on behalf of Amicus Curiae, Legal Services of New Jersey.
Good morning, Your Honors. Adam Beatenbender, Burkmore Law Group, on behalf of Respondent Bank of America.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. We offered Mr. Mayor, counsel, appointed counsel, and he declined that, and he just declined to appear on his behalf today. To Amicus LSNJ, we would imagine your time will be extended a bit. Please, Ms. Shore.
May it please the court. The issue before the court today is whether a cause of action for breach of contract for a closed-end debt payable in installments accrues on breach of the contract or whether it accrues on acceleration of the debt. Amicus Legal Services of New Jersey argues that the best interests of plaintiffs, defendants, and the judiciary are best served by reaffirming the well-settled rule that a cause of action for breach of contract accrues on the date that the contract is breached. This rule maintains an easily discernible and identifiable trigger for the accrual of a cause of action so that creditors, debtors, and courts can easily determine the date on which the statute of limitations begins to run and whether a claim is timely or time barred. It is also consistent with the statute of limitations for foreclosure actions, NJSA 2A:50-56.1, which the New Jersey legislature has determined runs from the date of default and not from the date of acceleration. It is also consistent with statutes of limitations in other contexts, such as the statute of limitations on sales of goods. This rule provides all parties with security and stability in their affairs. It prevents a creditor from strategically manipulating the running of the statute of limitations. It compels plaintiffs to act diligently to exercise their rights within a reasonable period of time. It provides defendants with a fair opportunity to defend claims against them while evidence is available, and it protects defendants from surprise. In this case, it also comports with the plain language of the contract between the parties, which was drafted by the plaintiff's predecessor in interest. The contract recognizes as an event of default the borrower's failure to make any minimum payment due. That's in the note, page 7, paragraph 12.1a. It allows, but does not require, the creditor the option to declare all sums due and owing under the agreement immediately due, commonly known as acceleration, or to take any other action permitted by the agreement or by law upon breach. That's in the note, paragraph 12b3. Neither the contract itself nor New Jersey law makes acceleration a prerequisite to suit. And even if it did, in similar contexts where pre-suit demand is required, New Jersey courts have held that any required pre-suit demand must be made within the statute of limitations. Historically, New Jersey courts have applied a different analysis only in the context of divisible contracts, otherwise sometimes called installment contracts. An installment contract in New Jersey is not the same thing as a contract that requires installment payments. An installment contract in New Jersey is a divisible contract, which is when performance is divided into two or more parts with a definite apportionment of the total consideration to each part. So in other words, part of the payment is offset, or the performance is offset by payment. As was the case in this court's decision in Metro Media. If this court holds that the statute of limitations on a debt payable in installments runs from the date of acceleration, then it should still reverse the decision of the appellate division, because even in states that hold that there's a separate statute of limitation on each payment that accrues as there's a default on that payment, in no state that I could find does acceleration revive an expired statute of limitations. So what happens in those states is that if acceleration happens at some point where some of the payments due might have expired, but some causes of action remain live, then the creditor can collect on those live causes of action, but the statute of limitations would have expired on the earlier ones. But it is universally accepted that acceleration requires clear and unequivocal communication to the debtor of the acceleration. And the only time in this case that there was a clear and unequivocal acceleration of the debt was back in 2014, when Bank of America filed a foreclosure action against Mr. Marr, in which it very clearly accelerated the debt. That was filed, I believe, on January, I want to say it was in 2014. It was either June or January of 2014. And clearly, if the debt was accelerated then even under the respondent's theory of the case, the statute of limitations would have run on the debt. In any event, if this court holds that the statute of limitations on a debt payable and installments runs from the date of acceleration, then it's crucial to New Jersey consumers that this court expressly limit that decision to closed-end debt with the maturity date. That is where the lender advances a specified amount of money and the borrower agrees to repay the principal and interest in substantially equal installments over a stated period of time with the maturity date. This court should specifically decline to apply this analysis to open-end debt such as credit card debt, because to hold otherwise would have the effect of eliminating any statute of limitations on open-end debt.
Let's come back to your first position. I take it you were done with your
remarks.
Let's come back to your first position. If the statute of limitations runs from the time a payment is missed and not when the acceleration clause is invoked, does that create an incentive for lenders to sue on the claim earlier and not allow a more fulsome grace period?
It does require bringing a claim earlier requires bringing the claim within 6 years, but that doesn't prevent any sort of fulsome or it doesn't prevent cure. It doesn't prevent negotiation. It doesn't prevent the debtor from catching up. Typically what happens in a case, in a installment, in a contract requiring installment payments is that if, let's say that the first payment was missed on December 25th, 2011, which is what they assert in their foreclosure complaint, that the first payment was missed December 25th, 2011. If at any point the debtor had made that payment and cured that default, that would have been the end, that no more clock is running on non-payment of that debt. If at any point that had been cured. But instead of that debt being cured, at that point, what happened in this particular case is two additional years ran when no payments whatsoever were made. And then at that point, additional debt had accrued. And then a lump sum payment was made at that point. Sometime during the pendency of the foreclosure action, there was a lump sum payment made. But according to their own records, that didn't cure that initial default. There was still arrears that were due at that point. So if at any point that had been cured, that statute of limitations would have stopped running. And if there was a new default, then a statute of limitations would have begun to accrue on the new default. In any event, in my experience, the sooner that a creditor acts on a default, the better the debtor's chances are of curing the default. The longer the period of time is allowed to run and the bigger the debt is allowed to get, the more difficult it becomes for a debtor to cure.
So give us your view on this. Suppose someone has a multi-year period to pay back a loan. In year one, they miss two payments. They're not cured, but they make the other 10. In year three, the same thing happens. And in year six, they stop paying altogether. If the lender wants to recover all, in order to capture year one, they have to sue fairly quickly after all payments have ceased. They'd have to sue in year seven. Does that make sense? And is that, and that's why I asked you about a shortened grace period. Is that a realistic thing? Is that a correct interpretation of your position with respect to the date the statute runs?
So as a practical matter, if That's the way creditors, and I think it's even clear in the note here, that when a payment is made, it's applied to the oldest balance first. So you wouldn't have a situation where you have a hole, like a Swiss cheese hole or a donut hole in payment, where one payment is missed, but then the rest of the payments were made. And so you're worried about that donut hole causing some sort of statute of limitations to run on the rest of the payments. That's just not how—
Under that hypothetical, when does the statute run for the missed payments in years one and three? If they're being— if the hole is being filled constantly with new payments?
If the default is cured by some payment, so let's just to make life easier, let's just say $100 was due in year one.
Okay.
And then at some point, the debtor pays that $100 and that $100 gets applied to that missed payment.
Right.
Right.
So in theory, though, there's still a month missing.
Right.
Where is that on the ledger sheet? Is that in year one? Is that in year six?
So if the note permits the creditor to apply the payments to the oldest balance, then if the default is cured by any payments along the way, it's cured. And the new default is when there's a new missed payment. And so it would extend the statute of limitations if that's the way the creditor is doing its bookkeeping, which is how things typically happen.
But again, if there's a month or two that's missed and subsequent payments for the same amount, for the same monthly payment are made and applied to the missed payments, they're still— the debtor still wouldn't be up to date with their payments because there is still technically missing payments. At what point do you determine when the statute of limitation begins to run on those missing payments, and when does that start?
So I would look to Midland Funding versus Thiel, which is the appellate division decision that governs collection actions in credit card cases. And what the appellate division held in Midland Funding versus Thiel is any payment short of a full installment payment due is a default. And that's when the statute of limitations begins to run. So a partial payment that didn't fully cure the default, the statute of limitations would run if there was only a partial payment that didn't cure the default.
But your position seems to take a slightly different tack. You've got 10 payments made in year one, not 12. But in year two, you're saying the first and second payments will fill that hole, so the statute of limitations has not yet begun to run.
That's correct, if they're full payments. If they're partial payments, it's a different thing.
But you're not making that up. You're just saying that that's how lenders are applying the payments. So that's the way the contract is written says when you miss a payment, if you then make a payment afterwards, it will apply towards your missed payment, not towards the— even if you make the payment in year two, it won't apply to year two. It'll apply to year one, because that's how the creditors themselves are choosing to write the contracts. They're choosing
exactly
to apply
right.
the payments. That's their choice.
Is that the standard contract?
In my experience, it is. In my experience, that's standard accounting, and it happens in all contexts that I'm familiar with. So
including mortgage payments.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not just credit card.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's why a foreclosure action begins to run anytime the statute of limitations, 6 years for a foreclosure action, begins to run anytime there's a missed payment.
The date of default starts that running.
And if it's cured, then there is nothing left to foreclose upon because it has been cured. As long as you cure within the 6 years, you're fine. And so there's an automatic kind of grace period of 6 years in that as long as you cure within the time that the statute of limitations is running, there's nothing left to sue upon.
But
if you do not cure within that period of time, then the statute of limitations begins to run and will eventually run out.
Yes, Your Honor.
So in the hypothetical that I gave you, where year six was when all payments stopped, but there were four missing payments earlier, the statute of limitations would run at year 5 and 8 months. That's when it would begin.
I'm having trouble not being able to sort of write it down, but
the first year one, two payments are missed, year three, two payments are missed, but otherwise payments are made until year six. So the statute of limitations with the backfilling, if you will, would not start until 4 months shy of year six. Fair? I think that helps your position. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I'm just having a cognitive, I'm a very visual person, and without being able
to. It doesn't begin to run until close to year six.
Let's not do the math.
Okay.
I'll go with you.
And that's just because if a payment is, if there's a default that's then cured, there is nothing to sue upon. But if the default is never cured by the time the 6 years have run, then that's it.
That's exactly my position. Yes, thank you.
Counsel, I'm confused though by the factual recitation, because as my notes reflect, and maybe I misunderstood, you said the first payment was missed December 5th, 2011. You said that debt was never cured. Even though a lump sum payment was made, that didn't cure the initial default. I don't understand how that jives with what you're saying now.
Because by the time the lump sum payment was made, the default wasn't just that 1 month's payment. It was that month's payment and all the payments up until the date that some lump sum was made. And even when that lump sum was made, it didn't cure any of that default. There was still all of that default.
That's because payment stopped in December 19th, 2011 and did not resume until March 27th, 2013. And then only until July 25th, 2014 in various amounts, never enough. They were applied to the arrears, but it was never enough to bring the loan current after that default.
Correct. So there was a continuing default that was never cured from 2011 all the way forward.
So keep your hands up for a second. So what you're saying really then is that as that lump sum payment was made in 14, this left hand moves this way.
Yes.
Okay.
But it was never closed.
Can I follow up on that? Back to the chief's original hypothetical. So are you saying that unless you make double payments in the current months to take care of the current and the prior, you're going to continue to be in default, and it's the original breach that counts for the statute of limitations to run?
No, I think it's the opposite.
It's not the original breach, right? Because it's the original month is filled in. It's whatever.
The original month, it continues to backfill as payments are being made, right. But at some point, but there's still not enough money. But, you know, the current payments aren't being made.
Unless a person makes a double payment and covers the current and the past.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a double payment, if there's a default, in order to stop that statute of limitations from running, that default has to be cured. Sure. If the default continues month after month after month after month and grows and grows and grows and grows with no payment made, then the statute of limitations begins to run here. The respondent characterized in its response to the petition for certification, characterized the defendant's breach as a micro breach and argued that it would have been inappropriate to sue on a micro breach. But this is not a micro breach. This was no payments between 2011 and 2013, and then some lump sum payment in 2014. And then from 2014, for 6 years, so 12 payments times 6 years, which my math in my head is bad, but what is that, 72 months? Something along those lines. He missed payments for 72 months, and the house had been foreclosed upon by the primary lender in that period of time. To call that a micro breach, or to say that there's some sort of bad public policy from permitting, from requiring a lender to sue during that 6 year period of missed payment.
But isn't there bad policy? Because the practical effect, lenders are risk averse. And I would suggest that the people who are within a lender organization do not want to be telling their bosses that the statute has run on their claim because they were too tolerant of what was going on with a particular borrower. I respectfully, whatever impact it might have on this case, I would respectfully suggest that the rule you are urging us to adopt for purposes of this case would cause more people to have actions taken against them in not 6 years later, 6 months later, when it looks like a a debt is going south, it would encourage lenders to take aggressive action immediately, and that is not good for borrowers.
Your Honor, truthfully, in my experience, it's better for borrowers for two reasons. It's easier to cure a smaller default than it is. And so curing the default or coming to having some resolution of that default, whether it's a settled default or whether it's a judicial decision on that default sooner, allows people to cure much more readily than letting the debt grow exponentially month after month after month.
Don't many of your clients, I'm not asking about any specifics, engage in a negotiation process, which can take significant time?
Certainly, people try to negotiate debts.
And often the lenders are willing to put people on a new schedule and to work with them. I'm just thinking about the potential impact on the willingness of lenders to undertake a process that could take years if they are looking at the prospect of being told by a court that you should have sued earlier, you should not have allowed this to go on, and you're out of luck. And this is, you know, obviously people in an organization are trying not to be responsible for losses. You're out of luck because you worked with this debtor too long.
Working with the debtor doesn't extend. So let's say that the lender files a lawsuit against the debtor, and they come to a negotiated resolution of that includes a payment plan for the debtor. Now the statute of limitations problem is taken care of. And
it would start to run anew if they missed the payment plan.
Under the settlement agreement.
If it's a formal settlement.
That's exactly right, which is why bringing the action and then continuing to negotiate and resolve it is in the interest of both parties.
So it seems like your position, I mean, to follow up on Justice Patterson's questions, it seems like your position is debtors would welcome being taken to court as opposed to having more of a grace period and having the ability to work on the debt possibly connected to their house and where they live. They would welcome being taken to court as opposed to having an opportunity to cure their debt.
So I don't think that that's the argument that I'm making. I don't think anybody welcomes being taken to court.
I think you said something along the lines of it's better for the debtors to be taken to court and have the opportunity to cure, or I guess be forced to cure their debt sooner rather than later, even if it is 6 months later. I mean, we have, you know, this HELOC. This is a HELOC that, you know, this is over the course of many, many years that this could be paid, but you're advocating for action to be taken in court very soon after an initial default.
Not exactly, Your Honor. I'm advocating for action to be taken within the statute of limitations, which the legislature has said is 6 years. The legislature has said 6 years is plenty of time for a creditor to exercise its right to collect on that debt. They can bring that lawsuit on the fifth year, 11th month, if they want to take their time and try to negotiate something out with the debtor. Nothing prevents them from doing that.
And that applies for a mortgage as well. So a foreclosure action must be filed within 6 years of the initial time that you miss any payment. So if you have to make a monthly payment of $3,000 and you only make a monthly payment of $2,000 and you never cure that. So I guess in your argument, you're saying you never make another payment because after that, if you did make another payment, it would go back to cure. So the statute of limitations would kind of start over every time. But if you stop making payments altogether, then they have to sue within 6 years. And that's what the legislature has decided.
That's exactly right.
What's your experience in terms of the impact on negotiations if the lender has to get a lawyer, file suit, and absorb all of those costs?
My personal experience is that a lot of our clients at Legal Services of New Jersey need to rely sometimes on charitable organizations or government programs that can assist them with defaults. So, you know, sometimes there's money available to help with defaults, particularly when somebody's home is at issue. So, for example, during the mortgage, during COVID, there were was a program administered by the New Jersey Housing and Mortgage Finance Agency that helped people cure their arrears. And in order for a lot of these programs to even consider an application, they want to see that the debtor is in some kind of danger of losing their home. So if somebody is applying for rental assistance, agencies want to see an eviction complaint. If somebody is applying for foreclosure assistance, the agencies want to see a foreclosure complaint.
So again, the foreclosures complaint helps the debtor?
In a strange way. And, you know, maybe that's, you know, a different problem that agencies are requiring that. But that's my experience of what happens. And so if the homeowner comes forward and says, well, I owe all this money, but I can't prove that I'm in any danger of foreclosure or eviction, then oftentimes it's difficult to get an agency to consider that the kind of situation where they will provide assistance.
And here the specific contract sets forth that it would be breached if, quote, I fail to meet the repayment terms of the agreement, such as my failure to make any minimum payment due to you on or before the payment due date.
Yes, Your Honor.
So anytime that a minimum payment was not made, that constitutes a breach of this contract.
Yes, Your Honor. Those are the express terms of the contract. And the lender had various remedies that it could choose from as a result of that breach. And those are not the only breaches. So, for example, the loan could have been completely current. The debtor could have paid every payment under the agreement, but not paid the property taxes. That would have enabled the creditor to accelerate the debt, even though the debt was fully paid, and then sue for that breach, or even without acceleration, potentially. I haven't thought that through. But
so any on any debt as to which there is any kind of breach, even if it's minimal, the minimal sufficient to meet the contract terms for a breach, there has to be a lawsuit within 6 years unless there's a settlement, or the lender's going to lose their rights.
I think that's what the legislature has said, Your Honor. But I can't imagine that there would be a minimal breach that lasted for 6 years. I can't envision a factual scenario where that's possible. Because if it's, like I said, if there's one missed payment, chances are that's going to get cured in subsequent months, and that statute of limitations is not going to be an issue anymore.
Isn't the reality that people fall behind and then continue to make payments trying to keep up, and they're not being sued, so they continue to make their payments on a monthly basis, but they're not quite up to date because they can't catch up with the previous payments, and the lenders are allowing it to allow them to stay in their home and allow the contract to move forward. So aren't you asking for them to be sued on every minor breach in order for the lender to maintain their ability to collect their final amount?
Well, no, Your Honor, because if the breach gets cured, then there's no more cause of action to get sued on.
But if it can't be cured,
Month's payment, if then the next month they pay, that month is cured.
But they have to pay double to catch up.
They have to pay the original month to cure that default.
Right.
And now maybe they're in default this month.
I think that point is the statute of limitations, because a payment is going to the oldest debt that wasn't paid, it could actually be, in theory, 12 years instead of six. If you miss 1 month, but then you're paying every single month after that, and then all of a sudden you stop paying 6 years later, it will really be 12 years from the time you originally missed the payment until the statute of limitations finally runs, because every time you paid after that, it went to the previous month, and it went to the previous month, and it went to the previous month. And so only when you stop paying altogether, let's say you miss a payment in 2011, then you pay between 2011 and 2017, each one is credited to the month before. All of a sudden, in 2017, you stop paying altogether. Statute of limitations is only running in 2023 because every other payment had been credited to the last payment, correct?
Yes, correct.
Can you tell us where in the contract it provides for that? Paragraph 12A1 speaks about the breach.
Right.
Let me see where it's a late payment curing act. If it would be easier, I'd ask you to tell us later.
Okay, that would be, that would probably help because I need to look at the
it's not quite so easy to read. The font is a little small as
well. Right, it's a little small.
Any other questions?
Please. You said before, Counselor, that these are not micro breaches, but there's New Jersey case law that says that they are partial breaches, and they're only full breaches if they're accompanied by an expression of anticipatory repudiation. How do you square those circles?
So, Your Honor, that's the case law in the instance of divisible contracts. Divisible contracts are contracts like the one in Metro Media or the one in Valencia, FDIC versus Valencia Pork Store, where each month's payment is made in exchange for the other party's performance. So the quintessential example of that is in a lease. Or in Metro Media, where the issue was every month there were cleaning services that were, the office space got cleaned and a bill was generated for that month's cleaning of the office space. And there should have been a presentment of that bill within a 6-year period of time. And so there's performance and there's payment for that performance in a divisible contract. So in those cases, those are divisible contracts where each missed payment has its own independent statute of limitations due date. That's a different kind of contract than the one that we have here. The one that we have here is more akin to the contract that Judge Accurso reviewed in the decision in the Bill Jim case that I cite in the payments, in the papers. In that case, it's a construction contract. It's one contract for performance of, specified job, but there were payments that were to be made along the way in that construction contract, progress payments to be made along the way. And the argument was made that each payment on that contract had its own independent due date and had to be sued on independently. And Judge Accurso said, no, that's not a divisible contract where the progress payments were for a specific part of the performance. It was one whole contract with individual progress payments along the way. So the progress payments were not one for one in exchange. I pay you for this particular piece of work, or I pay you for this month's cleaning bills. This is not that kind of contract. This is one contract with installment payments. And there is no case in New Jersey that finds that that type of contract, where it's one contract with individual payments, where each payment has its own individual due date. In fact, in the case of Security National Partners versus Mahler, which is a foreclosure case that I also cite in the payment papers, the appellate division, sort of as a throwaway statement, says the plaintiff concedes, as it must, that a suit on the note in that particular case would have been time barred because it was not brought within 6 years of the default date. So, in other words, that's the practice. That's really how statutes of limitations are typically interpreted in New Jersey. Everyone agreed in Security National Partners versus Mahler that the statute of limitations had expired. It was not revolutionary. It was, of course, naturally, that's the law in New Jersey. That's what happens. Statutes of limitations expire 6 years after they accrue. And so that's what happened here. And then, again, this isn't a partial breach. It's difficult to imagine a more total breach than non-payment of the contract from 2014 all the way through the entire, even if you ignore the 2011 default and the partial payments, pretend all that didn't happen. The last payment made on the debt at all was in 2014. There had been no other payment for over 70 months, and the property had already been foreclosed upon. Why? There's nothing in the respondents' papers whatsoever that explains why in 5 years and 11 months after that June 2014 payment, they weren't able to bring a lawsuit. Not only that, I'll also say that there was no acceleration here, other than the acceleration that happened in the foreclosure lawsuit brought in 2014. That's the only place where the lender ever accelerated the debt. What they're relying on,
right, an optional acceleration clause that could have used here.
Yes, exactly.
And you're saying that in the setting that we see here, the fact of an optional acceleration clause in the contract has no impact on the statute of limitations.
It depends on what the breach was. So, for example, let's say that the breach was that the The acceleration clause does not have an impact on the statute of limitations. If the lender chose to accelerate, the lender was required to accelerate during the statute of limitations. And there's case law to that effect, not in this context, but in a similar context.
If the lender had accelerated pursuant to the acceleration clause in this case, within the six-year period, would that have an impact on the statute of limitations?
No, I don't think that it would have. The statute of limitations runs on breach. If the reason for the acceleration had been, let's say, that the homeowner didn't pay their property taxes, and then as a result of that, the lender had accelerated, but then didn't bring suit for 6 years, then I think it would have an impact on the statute of limitations, because then I think the lender would have accelerated and then not pursued that acceleration within the 6 years.
So here again, aren't you seeking a rule that would require the most aggressive possible action on the part of the lender to protect its rights under the statute of limitations, and that is accelerate and sue?
I don't think acceleration was a prerequisite to suit in this particular case.
I understand, but what you're saying is to get the benefit of its acceleration clause, let's say in a situation where somebody gets in trouble with property taxes, the lender, in order to get a benefit in terms of the timeliness of its suit, would have to accelerate and then bring a lawsuit, not in 2 weeks, but following the acceleration. And that is the most aggressive possible strategy on the part of the lender.
I don't think it's aggressive to wait 5 years and 11 months. I think to require the lender to comply with New Jersey law and to sue within the statute of limitations if it wants a remedy is not aggressive. It's practical.
No, I'm not saying it's aggressive toward the lender. I'm saying that the rule you're seeking, it seems to me, would incentivize aggressive strategy and tactics on the part of the lender. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, simply to preserve what could be a significant amount of money and not lose it by letting the statute of limitations run.
I hear you, Your Honor. I don't think that it's an aggressive strategy on the part of a lender to sue at the 5 year, 11 month mark. I don't see that that's, you know, as aggressive as possible.
That's required in a normal mortgage action in any case, correct? There's no debate about this. In a mortgage action, if you wait more than 6 years after the default, that's it.
That's correct. I mean, it would be very aggressive. I would be requiring something very aggressive on the part of the lender if what I were saying to the lender is, there's a breach, you better bring that cause of action the month that there's a breach, or within a couple of months or within a year. But nobody is suggesting that. And the only suggestion I'm making is that they bring it within the statute of limitations, which the legislature has set at 6 years. So if they think it's in their interest for some reason to wait 5 years and 11 months for any reason, they have every right to do that. They just have to act within the 6 years.
We recognize you're amicus and you're not representing Mr. Mayor in this case. So if you can answer this and defer to counsel across the aisle, that's fine. But you said there was no acceleration of the debt. On March 23rd of 2015, the bank wrote off the debt. Did it also accelerate the balance then? That's what the appellate division has in its opinion at page 3.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's what the appellate division decided, and that's what the trial court decided. And in our view, that's wrongly decided.
That's a factual question about whether they accelerated, no?
So the only thing that happened on March 13th was the charge off. And so in the statement of facts, I go through that. There was no communication to the debtor of the charge off. There's no dispute in the record that there was no communication of that charge off to the debtor. So the only thing that happened was that on their books, they indicated that the debt was charged off. And there is not a state in the United States that would consider that a valid acceleration.
Sorry, and when you look at the, I think I have this little chart, the Bank of America home loans transaction date, and it says March 23rd, 2015. And next to it, it says billing adjustment and principal adjustment. Is that what you're referring to as the only notation in their records as to anything happening on March 23rd, 2015?
Yes. And also there's a certification from a representative of Bank of America that was submitted on the motion for summary judgment, where there's a little chart that indicates that the March 5th, 2015 date was the charge-off date.
And below,
So there's no affirmative statement, you're telling us, that the bank accelerated the date, whether on March 23rd, 2015 or some other date.
The only date that there's any acceleration is in the foreclosure complaint that Bank of America filed in 2014. In 2014, Bank of America filed a foreclosure complaint in which it expressly accelerated the debt, and it never revoked that acceleration.
I'm puzzled now. I thought you said earlier they never accelerated, and now you're telling us they did so in 2014 in the context of the foreclosure action?
I'm sorry if I misspoke and said that they never accelerated. They didn't accelerate by virtue of the 2015 charge-off. That was not an acceleration in 2015. But in 2014, they filed a foreclosure complaint against Mr. Maher, in which they expressly accelerated the debt.
And that allegation reads, it's from January 10th, 2014, quote, plaintiff herein, by reason of said default, elected that the whole unpaid principal sum due on the aforesaid obligation and mortgage referred to in paragraphs 1 and 2 above, with all unpaid interest and advances made thereon, shall now be due, period. Exactly. That is the acceleration, correct?
That's exactly right.
And that was from the lawsuit filed on January 10th, 2014.
That's correct.
So your dispute is with the date on which the acceleration clause was declared.
I think that might be accurate. I think they might, I don't know, because there was no reply papers. They might take the position that that default was cured and that that's enough. And that's another whole new debate about whether, their voluntary dismissal of that foreclosure complaint did away with that acceleration, or whether that
payment was made thereafter.
I'm sorry?
The payments that came in from the debtor was made after that complaint.
Yes, they did. Correct. They accepted.
And then the complaint was dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor, but it wasn't a full payment. And in fact, New Jersey law has New Jersey has the Fair Foreclosure Act. And the Fair Foreclosure Act says that if, under those sort of circumstances, there's a foreclosure complaint pending, and then the debtor cures the default, then the Fair Foreclosure Act, which is 2A:50-57 in subsection E, it says in part, if a default is cured after filing of a foreclosure action, the lender shall give written notice of the cure to the court. Upon such notice, the court shall dismiss the action without prejudice. And that's not what happened.
Once an acceleration has occurred, and doesn't the lender have to take some action to undo that?
Yes, exactly.
Not simply, it doesn't go away simply because there's a partial cure of the default.
That's exactly my point, Your Honor.
So this debt, from the time that the foreclosure complaint was filed, was in an accelerated status.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was on January 10th, 2014. And here they didn't sue within 6 years of January 10th, 2014. So that's why you brought up that if there was any acceleration, it was on January 10th, 2014, correct?
That's exactly right. But I would caution the court about relying on acceleration as the thing that instigates the running of the statute of limitations, because I would suggest to the court that you look to New York and see what's happening in New York, because the rule in New York is that each payment has its own due date and its own statute of limitations. And if the debt gets accelerated, the statute of limitations on the whole debt begins to run on the date of the acceleration. And so what happened during the foreclosure crisis is that many lenders initiated foreclosure actions and instituted and accelerated the debt in connection with those foreclosure actions, and then dismissed those foreclosure actions for one reason or another. And now 6 years have gone by since the date of those accelerations. And in New York, homeowners are bringing claims to for quiet title, essentially, saying they no longer have any cause of action because they accelerated the debt more than 6 years ago and didn't move on it, so free house. And I think that's what this court doesn't want to have happen.
Is that by statute in New York?
Yes, it is by statute. Partially by statute, a combination of case law and statute.
Seeing no other questions, Ms. Shore, we thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for filling in the way that you did. Mr. Biedenbender.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Adam Biedenbender here on behalf of Respondent Bank of America. There's one question that Mr. Mayor has certified up on appeal, and that is whether the bank's breach of contract claim accrued upon last payment or default in 2014 or upon charge-off and acceleration in 2015. Mr. Mayer's arguments and the amici's arguments have been rejected below, and that rejection was based on the precedent from Valencia Pork and In Re Estate of Balk. And those cases hold that a mere missed payment is only a partial breach unless there's a repudiation. They hold that a single default does not automatically accelerate maturity or authorize the debtor to take advantage of his default in computing the period of limitation. And they hold that when an acceleration clause is activated, the debt becomes immediately due and payable, the cause of action accrues, and the six-year limitations period begins running. So until an installment contract's charged off and accelerated, a creditor only holds a claim for that arrearage, the prior missed payments. You know, think of a credit card statement. You may carry a balance of $10,000, but they ask you for a monthly payment of $400, for example. If you don't make that payment, and they don't charge off, they don't accelerate, your next statement's not going to ask you for $10,000. It's going to ask you for $800. And until that charge off and acceleration happens, that's how the installment contract operates. On the evidentiary front, the trial court and the Court of Appeals found that Bank of America charged off and accelerated on March 23rd, 2015, a date within 6 years of suit. That finding was supported by the transaction history that we just discussed, which shows a series of monthly transactions, monthly payments, you know, a few thousand dollars, monthly fees. And then on March 23rd, 2015, a $785,000 total loss booked by the bank. They accelerated the future monthly payments, took a $785,000 loss. Mr. Mayer and Amici appear to believe that any missed payment required Bank of America to essentially charge off and accelerate immediately. That's not what Valencia Pork and Balk say, and that's also not what the party's contract says. Section 17J of the contract, like most loan contracts, provides that Bank of America can accept late payments or delay in enforcing its rights without waiving those rights. So it's our position that the law is clear that the claim for $785,000 did not accrue immediately upon default, but rather upon charge-off and acceleration. And to establish that the January 7, 2021 suit was untimely, Mr. Mayer would need to show that the bank charged off and accelerated the debt prior to January 7, 2015, and he has not done so. In addition to Mr. Mayer's arguments, the Amici have raised some new issues that we just discussed. First, the 2014 foreclosure action, they claim that was an acceleration. We believe that's irrelevant for two reasons. The 2014 foreclosure was not discussed below. It's not in the record. It's not properly up on appeal. Second, obviously that 2014 foreclosure was not completed. We know that because U.S. Bank foreclosed against the collateral property in 2017. And if we look at the 2014 foreclosure case, we see that it was dismissed. The dismissal notes that the matter was amicably adjusted between the parties. And if we look at what the record does show, that transaction history, Mr. Mayer made cure payments in 2014 during the pendency of the foreclosure. He paid over $200,000. He cured the prior default, brought the loan current, then didn't make any payments after the foreclosure was dismissed. So as held in bulk, a mere default cannot be the basis for a total breach if it's cured. We just discussed the New Jersey Fair Foreclosure Act, which does indeed provide that a debtor always has the right to cure his default before the completion of foreclosure. And in doing so, the debt is decelerated. Any prior acceleration is undone and the debt is decelerated. So even if the debt was accelerated upon initiation of the 2014 foreclosure action, it was decelerated upon cure and dismissal. Next, the Amici have argued that Bank of America never accelerated at any time. And we believe that argument fails for two reasons. Again, it was not raised below. It was not presented in the petition for certiorari. And it's also somewhat irrelevant in our opinion, because there is in the record additional evidence of acceleration. Even if we determine that there was no acceleration in 2015, in the record, there's a notice of acceleration from 2019. It was sent to the borrowers. So the 2021 lawsuit would certainly be filed within 6 years of the 2019 acceleration notice. We contend that there was an acceleration back in 2015. We're not attempting to rely on the 2019 notice, but it is there, it exists. And finally, some of the policy arguments we've discussed. The Amici contend that the law as is somewhat improperly allows creditors to artificially extend the life of their claims if they can pick their own claim accrual dates via charge-off and acceleration. But that's not what happened here. There's no strategic delay here. Bank of America acted within the period contemplated by federal regulators. Mr. Mayer's last payment was July of 2014. So his account wasn't even in default until August of 2014, a month later. The debt was charged off and accelerated 7 months after that, March of 2015. The FDIC and the OCC, the regulators in this space, recommend that creditors charge off these loans after they've been delinquent 180 days, so 6 months. So contrary to the Amici's position, bank regulators expressly contemplate that debts won't be charged off and accelerated immediately upon default. That would not be good for consumers. And the Court of Appeals below recognized those policy concerns and held that if the statute of limitations runs from last payment, that does disincentivize lenders' good faith efforts to offer grace periods and workouts to borrowers.
Thank you for pointing us to paragraph 17J. You said earlier, though, that the $200,000 payment cured the prior default. So then what does 17J entitle you to do?
I think 17J gives the lender the ability to waive a mispayment. So often borrowers will say, you allowed me to make an underpayment that modified the contract. You've somehow altered your rights. But that payment, that clause, amongst other things, gives the bank the ability to be flexible and explore workout options with borrowers.
Does that mean you have a cause of action for a later payment? Did it or did it not cure the original default?
It appears that the payments made during the pendency of the 2014 foreclosure action cured the prior default. And I was not counsel for the bank in that matter, but the dismissal order was a joint stipulated dismissal. And it says the matter's been amicably adjusted between the parties. And it was sufficient for the bank to say our claim as to whatever balance is in arrears is resolved. We are dismissing it at this time.
Do you agree with Ms. Shore's earlier statement that a late payment can cure the prior default and eviscerate the cause of action that potentially existed up until the late payment?
Yes, it can. And that all comes back to the billing statements. When you get those billing statements, you say, you know, it's assume $400 a month. You miss one payment. The next one says, for ease of simplicity, $800 a month. If you make your next $400 payment, you have not cured that default. If you make an $800 payment, I would agree that you have cured that default, fees and interest aside.
So assuming here that the last payment was July 25th, 2014, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So counsel for Amici was saying that the loan was never brought current after December 19th, 2011. you seem to be disagreeing with that. And you're saying that the loan was current until July 25th, 2014. But either way, no payment after July 25th, 2014. Why do you not have to sue within 6 years of that date, which would have been July 25th, 2020?
Practically speaking, the lenders will have a chart of when a claim accrues. And the current understanding is that if it's an installment contract in New Jersey, the claim accrues upon acceleration.
But why is that the understanding? Why should lenders be allowed? You actually just mentioned that even if the March 23rd, 2015 date did not count as an acceleration, because in the chart, all it says is billing adjustment and not any evidence of acceleration, there was an acceleration in 2019. So it seems like you're arguing that the lender can accelerate at any time, and then the statute of limitations does not start to run until then. And so they have 6 years from the date of acceleration. Why should that be permitted? There was a clear breach after July 25th, 2014, no payments. The only thing that Mr. Mayer had to do in this contract was make payments. So once he's not making payments, that's a complete breach. Why is it that the lender can just wait until whenever they decide, then decide to accelerate, and then get an extra 6 years from then?
I agree, Your Honor, that there are cases where there would be an unjustifiable delay between the final uncured default and what the lender is claiming is the acceleration. But I don't think this is that case, and that FDIC and OCC guidance that says 180 days, you should charge off, you should, you know, book this as a loss, that was pretty closely hewn to here. And I think it comes back to the fact that these are installment contracts, you know. So when you have that first breach, what would the lender file suit for? If the monthly payment, you know, if the balance is $10,000, the monthly payment's $400, they breach and it's uncured, until there's an acceleration, the lender's suit would be for $400. So that acceleration is pivotal in declaring the full debt due. That's when the lender's claim for the full debt first ripens.
So you have 6 years from then. So yes. Let's say you just have to put a little ticker that says person stopped paying and never paid again. 6 years after that, if the whole $300,000 is now due because they have missed all of those payments and at some point you accelerated it, why do you not have to sue within that period? It just seems like it gives the lender discretion to decide to sue whenever they choose, because they can wait to accelerate until whenever they choose, and then they have another 6 years after that.
I think it's because of the bright line rule is really helpful. And when you think about defaults, defaults happen in many different ways. And often, as was discussed earlier, there are these somewhat micro defaults, de minimis defaults. You know, one payment is a day late, a dollar short, and then all the other payments are good, consistent, as expected. What has happened? If the claim accrued upon default, do we need to go and unpack all of the monthly statements to find out that, oh goodness, they've been $400 in arrears for 5 years? Does that threaten the viability of our claim as to the entire debt, even though they're making payments? Do we need to sue this borrower who is currently making payments?
But that's the same with an initial mortgage, right? So an initial mortgage, you only have 6 years from the date of the missed payment, correct? You can't wait and accelerate whenever you want to?
I've never conducted a foreclosure before, so I will defer to the courts that that is the law, if that is the law. It's my understanding that that's not the law in the breach of contract money damages space.
Did you accelerate the contract in the foreclosure action in 2014?
I think that's pretty unequivocal that it was accelerated in initiating the foreclosure in 2014.
And that's the language that I read about plaintiff herein accelerates it.
Yeah,
so but then there was an amicable resolution. Seems like the bank worked with the lender and came to an agreement because a big payment was made. And from your representation, it was made current at that point. And so it was dismissed.
That's correct.
In the hopes that he would continue paying or what have you. But it seemed like there was some sort of negotiation, some flexibility with the lender to be able to work something out with the debtor.
Sorry, that's correct, Your Honor. That record evidences that there were substantial catch-up payments made during the pendency of the 2014 foreclosure action, which caused it to be dismissed by the agreement of the two parties.
What is your view of what strategy would be incentivized by the rule that your colleague over on this side is suggesting we adopt?
I do think that it would lead to more lawsuits being filed. I think that, you know, the banks are going to have a spreadsheet of when your claim accrues. And if the law becomes your claim accrues upon the first uncured default, that's going to be an earlier date than acceleration. And there will be more lawsuits filed by lenders seeking to preserve their rights to enforce the instrument.
And your colleague says that's not what it sounds like, which is a bad thing for borrowers. What is your response to that in based on your experience?
I think, you know, I don't want to hold myself out as a consumer advocate.
You're, not, you're representing
the attorney the bank. For the bank, but I will say, you know, in my experience as the attorney for the bank, banks have offer less settlement tolerance the more money they've had to spend trying to preserve their right on attorneys. And, you know, whether that's right or wrong, it's economically rational. So I think that would, you know, some harm would trickle down to consumers if that were the case.
In terms of your claim accruing on the first uncured default, that's generally the law in all other areas of the law, right? So if there's a breach of contract, you have to do something, you don't do it, then a claim accrues because you breached the contract, correct?
Generally, yes, if it's not an installment contract. And I think the difference between the installment contract and, say, just a pure promissory note of, I will pay you $50,000, you know, a week from now. It's very easy to determine when the claim for that full debt accrues. But when you're dealing with, you lent me $50,000 and I'm going to repay that to you over time at interest and monthly installments, there is a difference between a claim for a missed installment and a claim for the full balance. And that's why acceleration is relevant and is crucial in determining when that claim for the full balance accrued.
Sorry. So are you saying, I understand you were saying it wouldn't be in your financial interest to sue on the first default, but now it seemed like you were saying you legally wouldn't be permitted to sue on the first default. If someone, the contract clearly says that it would be breached if, quote, I fail to meet the repayment terms of the agreement, such as my failure to make any minimum payment due to you on or before the payment due date. So are you arguing that if a minimum payment is reached, you could not sue?
No, Your Honor, and I apologize if I misspoke there. I would say that you could sue, but you could only seek that missed payment unless there had been a charge off or acceleration. So probably, unless it was a massive mispayment, that there would not be economically rational.
And the FDIC would urge you to hold off.
Their guidance does speak to 6 months, 180 days before acceleration and charge off.
So I want to understand the breadth of your position. Hypothetically, putting aside the FDIC guidance, hypothetically, you could wait until 2026 to accelerate and wait until 2032 to sue on payments that were missed 20 years prior to that. Is that right?
In that hypothetical, if the claim accrues upon acceleration, then yes, but I would argue that delay would have to be explained. I would argue that that is inexplicable and that in the facts of that case, we should dig deeper. But I don't think this case is that case because we've got just a 7-month gap.
So mathematically, I've got it right. And you're saying, yes, mathematically, that's right. But there are regulators that come into play.
Correct, Your Honor.
Now, talk to us about those regulators. You said the FDIC has a 180-day rule. Or is there a general sort of rule of reasonableness that comes into play? Is there anything else that guides you from taking a position that mathematically you are allowed to take, but are you saying that by law you would be precluded from taking?
So in some cases, I note this just for whatever it's worth, in a prior jurisdiction, in a different jurisdiction, in a prior case, we had a 3-year gap between last payment and charge off and acceleration. And in that case, the lender on a HELOC in second position believed that that gap was reasonable because the first mortgagee was in foreclosure. And that foreclosure produced surplus funds that were payable to the second mortgagee. And the surplus funds almost extinguished the second mortgagee's debt, the HELOC, but not quite. So in that case, the theory was, we didn't accelerate because we thought we may be paid in full via the foreclosure, and we weren't even sure what the total balance would be until the foreclosure was completed. So once it was completed, we accelerated, and then our claim for what was left accrued.
So is it your position that as long as our acceleration is reasonable, we have that six-year bubble?
Yes, Your Honor.
When you talk about the FDIC guidance, what is that specifically, and where can I find it?
Yes. One second, Your Honor. So it is located in the FDIC's Uniform Retail Credit Classification and Account Management Policy, and also in OCC Bulletin 2000-20.
Is this in your briefing?
It is not, because this issue was not discussed below. I did print off some of the Federal Register documents in case Your Honors would like to review, but they are here.
Sorry, can you just tell the specific page in the Federal Register so that we can look it up?
Yes, Federal Register, Volume 65, Number 113. Page number is 36903. And that continues for a few pages through 36906.
And does that say that you cannot accelerate until 180 days? That you must accelerate within 180 days, that just generally acceleration within 180 days is a good idea? What is the specific rule?
It is neither a cannot nor a must, but more of the loose guidance at the end. It is open-ended retail loans that have been past due for 180 cumulative days from the due date should be classified as loss and charged off.
So again, so there's guidance. No way to legally enforce that, right?
It is guidance. You're correct, Your Honor. I don't think it is a strict directive.
So when you said that the cause of action should not accrue until the date of acceleration, but that if the acceleration was delayed, a court could consider that, pursuant to what? The way the legislature writes the statute of limitations is it's 6 years from the breach of contract. So here, if you're saying the contract isn't breached until the acceleration, although I'm not sure that that's what you're saying, but if that is what you're saying, the contract isn't breached until the acceleration, then under what authority would a court say you waited too long to accelerate? The FDIC does not say it must happen within 180 days, or if you try to do it outside of 180 days, it will be invalid, correct?
Correct.
So what authority would a court have to say, we understand the legislature has codified the statute of limitations, but we're going to not pay such close attention to that because we think that what you did was unfair?
I do think the court would have latitude in, I think one thing the court could do in that scenario is say, essentially, the statute of limitations on all of these individual mispayments lapsed long ago because you waited 10 years between the last payment to even accelerate. So honestly, there was nothing left for you to accelerate when you accelerated. I think that would be an interesting way to, I'm trying to think off my head in a hypothetical scenario.
But why wouldn't that even be the case here? Because there were many, many mispayments for which the statute of limitations ran 6 years before the lawsuit was filed. So why wouldn't all of those just be, sorry, you waited too long?
Well, I don't believe the evidence shows that the bank waited too long. I believe the evidence shows that it was cured, and then there was an acceleration seven months after the cure.
It sounds like similar to your response to Justice Hoffman's question that you were advocating for a reasonableness sort of inquiry. And here, it's the evidence shows that the bank asserted its rights, filed a complaint. There seemed to have been some sort of agreement, some sort of cure. The debtor stopped paying, and within 7 months, there was a charge off and acceleration. So it's not a case where there is 10 years or 20 years, which might result in a different result before a court if a lender was arguing that they were reasonable in asserting their rights.
Yeah, I think that's fair, Your Honor. I think there's always room for a reasonableness argument, which is evident from the FDIC and OCC guidance, which is also, I don't want to say loosey-goosey, but it is recommendations and guidelines rather than shalls or musts in this.
And that's for consumer protection purposes, the FDIC guidance, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Those are the primary bank regulators.
And to get people not sued the first time there's a deficiency in a payment.
Correct.
But does the FDIC say the statute of limitations shouldn't run until you decide to accelerate and that it's up to you when you decide to accelerate?
They don't weigh in on that, but it's my understanding that that is what Valencia Pork and Estate of Balk say, is that if it's a claim for an installment contract and you're seeking the full balance due under that instrument, then that claim does not accrue until charge-off and acceleration. It doesn't automatically accrue just because there is one missed monthly payment.
I'm not sure I understand what the FDIC guidance has as its purpose. Is it to make sure that the bank's books about what it believes are collectible debts are accurate? Or is it in any way related to what should be told to the borrower and all of those other things that we've been talking about?
I think there's absolutely a component of what you just mentioned in there where it is also, they're concerned also with markets, right? So if you have a performing loan on the books, it's an asset on the balance sheet, exactly. Right?
And that's what the FDIC is all about. They're the insurer of the bank, and they want to know that your balance sheets are accurate. So they're saying to you, if I understand the summary that you've given us, you should charge off these debts if they're not active for 180 days for 6 months. So help us understand this piece. When you charge off a debt, let me back up. When you accelerate a debt, you tell the borrower?
In this instance, the contract does not require notice of acceleration.
Is that standard practice?
I've seen contracts that require it, and I've seen contracts that do not require it. Neither, in my experience, is a predominant majority.
When you charge off the debt, do you tell the borrower?
This contract does not require that. And on that point, I have not seen many contracts that do require.
So beyond charging off of a debt, there would need to be some affirmative statement of acceleration?
Not under this instrument, Your Honor.
So you're saying you can wait to accelerate in any reasonable time and you don't have to tell the debtor. And then you get a new statute of limitations that runs from 6 years, but the debtor doesn't even know when the date is running from because they don't have to be informed about the acceleration.
It's correct that this contract did not require notice of default or acceleration.
So you, but don't you under the contract have to declare that all sums due and owing under the agreement are immediately due and payable?
I don't believe this contract contains that requirement. I could be mistaken, Your Honor.
If an event, and I'm reading from paragraph 12B, 12A says, failure to make a payment, dot, dot, dot. And then 12B says, if an event described in paragraph 12A occurs, you may do a combination of the following. 3, you may declare all sums owing under this agreement and any other agreement I've made with you to be immediately due and payable. That's a declaration that you're accelerating the debt, no?
I read that to mean that the creditor may accelerate the debt, but I don't read that clause to state that they must provide a notice to the debtor.
What does declare mean? Who's the declaration being made to?
I believe in this instance, there is a declaration of acceleration in the transaction history.
And sorry, by that, you just mean this little chart that has a bunch of dates on it. And under 323-2005, it says principal adjustment.
Correct, Your Honor.
But how would the creditor have access to that?
How would the debtor?
Sorry, yes.
That's fine. They would not. They do not have access to the transaction history.
Does that statement mean that all payments are due and payable immediately?
That means that the balance is now $785,000. If they want to cure it, they can no longer recommence their monthly payments and be considered in good standing under the loan.
Can you read the phrase again to us?
12B, Your Honor.
No, the language that we're just as after had been reading it.
I think all it says is principal ADJUST. It's a little, it's a bank ledger. And that's the only word that it says.
And is it your position that by saying principal adjust means that you've made a declaration that it's immediately due and payable?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that this is evidence of acceleration.
Is that going to change the statement that the debtor receives?
Actually, generally speaking, the debtors do not receive monthly statements after charge-off and acceleration because they would no longer say, pay me X dollars this month. It's just the full debt is due and
over. Do they get any notice that they now owe the full debt?
Not in this instance, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. So you're saying you can wait until within your discretion to accelerate, then you don't have to provide notice to the debtor. The debtor has no way to know that this has happened. And then the statute of limitations runs from that moment forth for 6 years.
Yes, Your Honor. Unless the contract
states that have this, that kind of rule.
I believe Florida also has law that states that claims for the breach of an installment contract, the full balance, do not accrue until acceleration. And if there's no contractual notice of acceleration requirement, I don't believe there's one required otherwise in the law. Georgia, I believe, is the same way, that acceleration notice is not required independent of the contract.
So perhaps two other states. How do you respond to the legal services counsel's argument that an installment contract is one where there has to be performance by both parties every month? And this is not an installment contract. It is simply one contract that requires installment payments in the same way that a regular mortgage would.
I would say that the estate of Balk case addresses that issue. There was an $800,000 promissory note that called for installment payments. And the court applied the same analysis, and they said a mispayment alone is insufficient to constitute a total breach of an installment contract unless it's accompanied by an anticipatory repudiation. So
that's New Jersey specific. You're saying it's not the majority rule in other states. It might be Florida and Georgia that might also have a similar rule.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you restate that question?
Does that fall into the, when I asked previously, are there other states that have a similar rule? And you said perhaps Florida and Georgia. Is that the same answer to this question as well?
Yes, Your Honor.
And just to confirm, no, I know you responded to many of the questions with regard to notice, indicating that this contract didn't require notice. In this case, there was no notice sent to defendant here with regard to the acceleration and charge-off.
We do have the 2019 notice that is in the record, and the defendants were sent a letter that said, you know, you owe $785,000, not a monthly statement asking for a monthly installment. So there is evidence in the record of an acceleration notice. It's just from 2019 instead of March of 2015.
So even though this contract didn't require notice, some notice was sent at some point.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Much later, and is it the case that nothing was sent in 2015, that it's just not in the record? Because it seems odd that a notice would be sent 4 years after the acceleration and charge off and not when that happened, even though notwithstanding the fact that it's not required for anything to be sent.
There is no other notice from 2015 of acceleration in the record.
But there was a negotiation after that, was there not?
That negotiation was 2014 during the pendency of that.
Okay, so after 15, acceleration occurs only on the internal records and the internal records of the bank. No notice to the consumer, to the debtor, and then we have the notice 4 years later. Has there been a change in the bank's policy with respect to giving notice of acceleration, whether or not it's technically required by the contract?
No change in policy. The 2019 acceleration notice letter was actually sent from prior counsel for the bank.
And for the in 2014, when the negotiation occurred and the settlement that led to the dismissal of the 2014 complaint, is there any indication aside from the notation that it was amicably settled that was there any notice to the debtor at that point? If you do not pay further payments within 6 months, we will charge off and accelerate. I'm just trying to understand what, that negotiation, I'm sure, wasn't just, oh, you've paid, this is great, we're going to dismiss the complaint. There must have been something more than that.
And there were, and this is where it gets a little odd, because this issue of was there ever an acceleration was not discussed below. So it's not in the record. But what happened, if I may, is that so the default is cured and the foreclosure is dismissed in August of 2014. And then monthly statements keep go out for a few months. Mr. Mayer doesn't make any more payments as shown on the transaction history. Then you have the acceleration in March of 2015. But those statements from in between August of 2014 and March of 2015 are not in the record. They just weren't at issue below because Mr. Mayer didn't argue that there was no charge off or acceleration in March of 2015. And the trial court simply found the evidence sufficient to find a charge off and acceleration in March of 2015. So we didn't get that granular.
Is there any dispute as to acceleration?
Not in our opinion.
There was none below, you're saying?
There was no dispute below about whether there was a charge off and acceleration in March of 2015. The full dispute was legal. When did the claim accrue? Mr. Mayer said it accrued back on my default in July of 2014. And the bank said, no, it did not accrue until charge off and acceleration in March of 2015. And we kind of had, everybody had accepted that those were the relevant dates to choose between. So we didn't get into.
Mr. Mayer, though, never had an attorney, correct?
Correct.
And I thought that in the legal services brief, it did say that Mr. Mayer did dispute that any acceleration took place on March 23rd, 2015.
I recall, I don't intend to, you know, I'm surmising, but his main argument, the issue he raised,
regardless of Maine,
yeah.
I think their brief states that he disputed that an acceleration took place on March 23rd, 2015.
I think that's fair. At a minimum, he would have, you know, denied that paragraph in his answer.
He said it was earlier.
And you can't prove there's no notice that he received except for 2019. Can we get a little more information about the 2019 notice? Was it sent to the house that had been foreclosed upon and in which he no longer lived?
It was sent to the 37 Ocean Avenue address.
That was the collateral that had been foreclosed upon in 2018, and a writ of possession had been executed against him, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So there's no evidence that he received any form of notice because he obviously could not have received notice that went to the property that had been foreclosed upon and where a writ of possession had been executed against him, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, but I don't want to, you know, belabor the point, but the contract did not require notice of acceleration.
Understood.
Counsel, are you relying upon a legal principle or a contractual provision to capture the payments from July 14th to January of 15? That would otherwise fall outside 6 years in the statute of limitations were that to start from the date of acceleration. What are you relying upon to capture those payments that are more than 6 years from the time at which a suit was filed? Is it a contractual provision or a legal principle?
Let me just look quickly at the transaction history, Your Honor. And I think what's interesting here is we may not even need to get that granular because in July of 2014, when Mr. Mayer made his final payment, the balance was $785,000, $785,000 and $259 and 21 cents. And that is still the balance that the bank is seeking at this point. So there's no additional interest or fees or principal or any sum other than the amounts that the balance was upon the date of last payment. So
isn't that more than 6 years before you filed the lawsuit?
Yes, the last payment is more than 6 years from when the lawsuit was filed.
So if you were owed the $785,259 more than 6 years before you filed the lawsuit, again, that means you can kind of extend the statute of limitations for as long as you want to.
I do believe there would have to be some reasonableness component that would not allow lenders to just extend the statute of limitations and delay acceleration in perpetuity.
Can I just go back? I'm sort of not clear on the answer. Is there a contractual provision or a legal principle that captures those six defaults that were more than 6 years from the date on which the bank filed suit?
I believe that it is more so the legal principle as embodied in Valencia Pork and Estate of Balk that says those partial breaches are not equivalent to an acceleration, and that the claim for the breach of the installment contract accrues upon that acceleration.
Other questions?
One more. Do most states require notice, whether or not it's in the contract, of an acceleration?
In the foreclosure context, I believe yes. In the monetary suit context, I have not seen many states that would require extra contractual notice of acceleration.
What's the common meaning of the word declare?
To state.
So a silent statement, a statement that is heard by no one except a ledger entry, would qualify.
To the tree in the forest at this point, I suppose. I admit that the transaction history was not sent to the borrower. The evidence of acceleration was not sent to the borrower.
In the 2014 lawsuit, the foreclosure lawsuit, what was the language used to make clear to all that the debt had been accelerated?
I don't have that in front of me right now, but I've just heard it discussed, and I agree that it was pretty clear and unequivocal language of acceleration.
Was it plaintiff herein, by reason of said default, elected that the whole unpaid principal sum due on the aforesaid obligation and mortgage referred to in paragraphs 1 and 2 above, with all unpaid interest and advances made thereon, shall now be due?
It's very, very clear.
To your understanding, there was no settlement agreement at that time that said something along the lines of, we're dismissing this complaint with that language that all payments are due and owing at this moment, if with the understanding that you will continue making payments, and if not, you will accelerate and all will be due and pay and owing in 6 months or something.
Correct.
There's no settlement agreement that your understanding is in the record.
No, Your Honor, I have not seen a settlement agreement from 2014.
The language from 2014 that was quite clear was not used in 2015. Is there anything, is that correct?
Correct.
Is there anything other than the entry that says principal adjust 2015?
There is not.
Other questions?
I just have one more, Chief. When I asked you before about a contractual provision or a legal principle, you deferred to a legal principle that captured the payments outside of the 6 years. Why isn't the answer 12B3 in the contract, which talks about accelerating all sums that are due and owing?
I think that's also a fair interpretation, Your Honor, in that an acceleration is an event that transforms this installment contract basically into a promissory note, for lack of a better term. It grabs prior missed payments, it grabs future unmade payments, and it sort of bakes them all into one pie and says, this is the balance. This is what you owe me. Any monthly payment will be insufficient to remain in good standing.
And if that's the case, is it your position that acceleration not only captures everything prospectively going forward in time, but everything retrospectively going back in time?
Yes, Your Honor.
No matter how long before? Or is that constrained by the sort of rule of reasonableness or 6 months that's recommended by the FDIC?
I would say that it captures everything, and that doing anything different would be extremely cumbersome. Because are you going back and looking through all of the prior monthly billing statements to say, oh, you know, he was $3 short. You know, if it's a 30-year mortgage, he was $3 short 20 years ago. Do we need to account for that in some manner? And I think that's part of the reason why some of the courts in Valencia Pork and the state of Balk have agreed on this bright line rule of acceleration, so that we don't need to do forensic accounting to ascertain the balance of every single credit card, HELOC, other contracts that's being litigated in New Jersey.
If we don't find that acceleration took place in 2015, what's the impact on your argument?
It would be my opinion that error would be harmless, because the record evidences that the debt was accelerated by 2019, because we do have that notice letter available. So there is uncontroverted evidence of acceleration within 6 years.
And your argument is that it was cured by 2014.
Yes.
That was cured in 2014. So the first default from your position occurred in August of 2014.
That's right. And it's really, it would be Mr. Mayer's burden to show that there was an acceleration more than 6 years prior to suit. So before January 7, 2015. And that's what the Amici have attempted to do with the 2014 foreclosure action, which there was an acceleration, but there was a cure and a deceleration.
Sorry, the 2019 acceleration, you said no notice received by him because it was sent only to the property that had already been foreclosed and for which a warrant of execution had already been entered against him, correct?
That's correct. But
so
the
in
bank
this case,
has,
could it still be that nothing has been accelerated? There's been no notice of acceleration to him, and now you could accelerate now and get an additional 6 years from now?
In theory, but that's we are saying that we accelerated all the way back in 2015. We're admitting that, and we're saying even if we didn't 2019, we're really trying to, you know, act in good faith and not artificially extend our claim into perpetuity.
As far as notice goes, it's fair to say that as of 2015, he has the $785,000, and it's notice to him in this contract that one of your options is to accelerate.
Correct.
How does 2019 satisfy that reasonableness test?
I would say because it's, in this instance, it's really just operating as a notice. It's our position that there was an acceleration in 2015, and that the 2019 letter is simply record evidence that the bank was treating the obligation as accelerated at that time.
So what happens from the perspective of the debtor? Does the debtor in this situation simply stop getting monthly statements?
Yes. In this instance, there were no monthly statements sent after March of 2015.
But the debtor is not told, by the way, you know, it's not Christmas in July. We haven't stopped sending monthly statements because you don't owe us money, but you owe us a lot of money.
I have not seen a notice of acceleration or another notice similar to what Your Honor just described in the record. No.
Respond to this if you can. When you're dealing with a case with $780,000 of debt, the individual, whether they get a piece of paper or not, has reason to think the bank hasn't forgotten about it. But if the debt is $5,000 and there's no notice and years pass, what's reasonable under those circumstances for a debtor to assume? Is it reasonable then to assume maybe the bank's just not going to go after me because I'm small fry or $2,000 loan?
I would say no. I would say it's a personal responsibility matter to make sure that you are aware of the status of your credit facilities.
For sure that's the case. But I think the reason you're getting questions about notice and what the borrower knows is somebody with a $2,000 debt that they should have paid and didn't pay. And years have passed and they've heard absolutely nothing. Is it unreasonable for them to think maybe they cut me a break because it's too expensive for them to try to collect at this point?
I would say yes. I would say that I would like to see evidence of any break that a bank is going to give me rather than just an assumption.
In your experience representing banks, do they pursue these modest amounts?
Not any of the creditors that I represent. There are small claims court cases that you do see filed for small balances. Yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Sure. Did you have anything to tell us about the contract, or have we covered it by the reference to 17J?
I believe it's covered, but Your Honor, if
I may be heard very, very briefly on the FDIC OCC point, I just want to mention that neither the FDIC nor the OCC says anything whatsoever about acceleration. They both refer to charge off, and as the Chief Justice indicated, it has to do with the financial security of the bank and not consumer protection. The only one other thing I'd like to mention, if you'll indulge me really briefly, is that this
rebuttal.
It's not rebuttal, I understand.
Of course not.
The only one other thing I'd like to mention is that this is an unusual situation because after foreclosure, there's a specific other statute of limitations that applies to collection of debts after foreclosure. So a primary mortgage holder has the foreclosure first rule. They have to foreclose before they could collect on a debt. If it's a secondary loan, after foreclosure, the secondary lender only has a one-year statute of limitations after the foreclosure in order to bring the collection action on the debt, on the note. They have a one-year statute of limitations unless they meet one of the exceptions. I'm referring to NJSA 2A:50-1, to 2A:50-12. And specifically, 2A:50-8 is what gives the secondary mortgage holder a one-year statute of limitations to bring a collection action after the primary mortgage holder has foreclosed. There are exceptions to that in NJSA 2. I'm sorry?
Are you contending that that applies here?
I am not sure whether it does because there are not sufficient facts in the record to determine below.
Has that ever been mentioned at any point in this case, as far as you know?
Only in our brief. But I think it's important if you're giving guidance to trial courts that are evaluating this type of case in the future that the analysis should start from whether the statute of limitations has run, should start from, does that statutory scheme apply or does it not apply? That's the first analysis. The second analysis is it a negotiable instrument and does that statute of limitations apply? And if the answer, as I agree with the respondent here, is that it's not a negotiable instrument, then the appropriate statute of limitations is 2A:14-1. One more. I just want to say that there's no proof in the record that establishes how the $785,000 amount was calculated. This is a note that has a strange adjustable interest rate, and there's nothing in the record that would allow us to establish whether that's the amount actually due. Thank you very much for your indulgence.
Thank you. I was giving you a bit of a challenge because you're amicus in this case, of course, and amicus doesn't get rebuttal. Let's take a brief recess and